Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make tabletop games as well. And today, I am only one quarter of this podcast rather than one third, because we have two, count them, two guests. And we're going to start with longtime returning guest, Sean. Hello, Sean. Welcome back.
How's it going? I'm Sean Jaffe. I'm part of Nerdy City and based out of Jersey City and doing RPGs.
And our other guest today is brand spanking new, although I've known him for a very long time. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, we always ask our guests to tell us who you are, even if we do know you.
My name is Christopher Boyer. I am a professional GM, freelance game designer, creative consultant. I live around the Peoria, Illinois area. Most of the time you can find me running games at my local library, at anime conventions around Illinois, and at Gen Con, where I'm usually working for Craig running his amazing, awesome, wonderful games.
Yes, Chris is a long time and multiple time contributor to a number of my games, and has been part of like the convention gang and all sorts of other things. But we will talk a little bit more about Chris's involvement in some Nerdburger game stuff in a little while.
Yeah, that's because we're talking about some topics that are very relevant to our two guests. We're talking, for our first half of the podcast, we're talking about paid GMing. Craig, you want to dive into this topic and then get our guests rolling on it?
Sure. I don't have a great deal that I can say about it other than what it is, because I have not actually done it myself. And that's why we have our guests here. So I'm going to play the part of interested outsider who's going to ask questions. Paid GMing. There are people out there who would love to play tabletop role-playing games who perhaps can't just manage to get that gaming group to pull together regularly. They want to play more often, or they may live someplace where there's just not a lot of gamers around. And so online is kind of the way to do it. And they would like to, you know, play in campaigns or even just play some one-shots and try out some new games. So with any other entertainment, they put a few bucks forward and get paid or professional GMs. They're kind of interchangeable terms. Unless either of the two of you want to argue that those are very specifically different terms. Like I said, I don't know. Sean initially brought up this topic to tackle. And then I asked Chris on board because he had been he's done some paid GMing as well. So, Sean, what jumped out at you about this particular topic? I already know the answer, but you can go ahead and tell everybody.
Well, I guess what jumped out at me is that this is it's my primary day job at this point. I am doing a fully packed back-to-back schedule at this point. I run Crooked Moon and Vampire the Masquerade at Bayonne on Mondays at a store called Fantasy Bay, which my boss would pillory me if I didn't shout it out. So if you do want to try role-playing, come to Fantasy Bay in Bayonne, and you're in the New Jersey Bayonne area. Then I am back there Wednesdays doing Dungeons and Dragons, because, you know, you got to do the classic. I run my own stuff on Tuesdays as like a playtesting thing. It's the only one that I'm not paid for. And then I run another game of that, Rememorex, on Thursdays for a client in Canada. Shout out to them. Go Milbro. then Fridays, it's on and off. I do West End Star Wars every other week. Saturdays is mostly for freelancing, or hopefully relaxing. And then Sunday, I do either back to back, or I'm always doing Dungeons and Dragons at a place in Traverse City called Victory Point. But sometimes I will also be working for Alamo Draft House, which does an
Oh.
event called oh yeah, they do an event called Dungeons and Draft House, and they are generally, if you're near a major city that has an Alamo Draft House, they're looking for DMs on for that, and it's they do one Sunday every month where they will be running a D&D one shot. All you really need to do is roll in and run the game that they hand you. It's all prepackaged, so it's pretty straightforward and easy to do. If you're looking for a way to get into paid GMing, I highly recommend it. Also, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Dungeon Books in Jersey City, which is like the indie game RPG shop in Jersey City, where I do a lot of freelance events. I'll be there next Saturday doing Remember X for a library event. So, dance card nearly full, but I am still available if anybody wants to hire me.
And Chris, you do paid jamming too?
I do. I'm not nearly as prolific as Sean is, and it is not my primary source of income. It is more of like a side hustle for me. Something that I do to help pay the bills that my primary job doesn't allow me to pay. And it's something that I enjoy doing. I have a paid game online, and then I also do a I volunteer and I do it at my local library. I run capers once a month.
So I think a lot of our audience members would want to know if they're interested in this topic and they want to know more about paid GMing. I think a lot of them are going to wonder, how do you find, and you already kind of talked about, how do you find jobs in paid GMing? How do you find paid GMing gigs?
Do you want to tackle the first part or the second part? What I how do you want to take the
Well, you guys could tell me how you guys found your gigs.
Well, I'll start then. For me, it started during the pandemic, and I just, sort of offered to friends online, and then it kind of word of mouth got out there. I've done a ton of conventions in my time, so a lot of people from, kind of all over have played in my games. And so, like, when it became clear during, especially during the pandemic, that, like, I this thing that people sometimes, they wait for me to do this at like Gen Con or something. Oh, we could just do this on a Tuesday. It really started picking up. But my recommendation is, so the pivot for the friendly local game store, I think, is part of one where I've noticed that a lot of the game stores, at least in the New York, New Jersey area, that have been like thriving, have sort of turned to a almost more of an event space. I mean, obviously they all sell games and they all make a lot of money on Magic and One Piece and Lorcana and whatever the card game du jour is. But there's also, something about like just running a game for like, X many dollars a head that shows up, and then, they sell snacks to those people. So that's kind of become where my bread and butter is those sorts of stores looking for people to run events for those. So literally, like, I just went into different game stores and I'm like, hi, I'm a paid GM, and if you have like a day that you want me to come in and run Dungeons and Dragons or Vampire the Masquerade or something nobody's ever heard of, like Remember X, I'd be happy to do that. And I have a weird relationship with D&D in general, but you got to be prepared to do 5e. I mean, that is where the money comes from. But once you've got a group that kind of settles in, and you're not, by the way, going to have the same five people every day. You know, every week it's not going to be the same. You need to learn how to like pivot with like this guy couldn't make it, that guy could, you're going to have to run anyway. But once you've got that, you can start to feel out like the group and be like, hey, you guys want to, you know, we've hit a break here in our D&D story. You guys want to try something a little bit more indie? And that gives you an opportunity to do that, which I enjoy.
Chris, how about you?
I found my gig. I found on the Nerdburger Discord, someone was looking for a paid GM. I basically did like an interview game, I guess you'd call it. I basically agreed to run like a free one shot for them, just to make sure that, you know, we were kind of on the same page in terms of like what they wanted to run and what I wanted to run. And I wanted to make sure that they wanted, my primary objective was I wanted them to be happy with me as a GM before we committed to anything long term, which they were. They loved me. I think we're on like our fourth or fifth campaign now of Capers. So that was how I got started. But I would say that of the two of us, I am a lot newer at this than Sean is. So as Sean is talking, I am taking notes. I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I never thought about that.
Yeah, I had a motive for. Yeah, Chris, I
I
invited you on. I
appreciate that.
invited you on just as much because you have done some, but also because I know you are looking for more. And Sean
Yes.
has done a whole bunch of it in a variety of kind of settings and kind of different approaches to getting there. And the interesting thing that I find about the things that you have all said is that in addition, there's online availability. You know, there are services that will help you to
Yeah,
find, like, here's somebody
there's
running
companies that do that.
this type of game. You can kind of sign up there as a GM to try to find players. Players will come looking for stuff. And so the thing that strikes me is that there's as many ways into paid GMing as there is like into freelancing for a game, or basically doing as there is into doing anything in the tabletop realm. Like, how do you get into publishing? How do you get into freelancing for your favorite game, or wanna, or how do you design your first game? There's so many ways to approach it. So we're gonna just try to touch on as much of those and
Yeah.
provide resources, ideas, encouragement for people who are looking to get into GMing, and hopefully maybe some people who are listening here too, who are not particularly less interested in GMing in that respect, but they're like, oh, this is like I'm the person who lives in the middle of nowhere and has can never get a group together or whatever, and like I didn't know these
Right.
things existed. I live near a big city, so I could go check that out and see if there's something happening. Call around to the store, see if there's events. Check their website, see if they actually have a schedule online. Or start looking online for the different services where like maybe I can just get on and play something with some folks from wherever, over Zoom or Discord or whatever. So there's
Most
so many opportunities,
game
so many
stores
different
do have
ways to do it.
that agenda. They do have, you know, like a schedule that you can jump in on. I don't think I've ever seen one that did have like a online schedule of here's, you know, what we're doing, and you just sort of look at that and see when there's, you know, an open space.
I mean, the nice thing about it is that you don't, unlike like freelancing for like writing an adventure or getting involved in that sort of way, you can just kind of do this on your own. Like you could put up, if you wanted to, you could put up flyers and just host them on your own. There's no one
That's
stopping you
true,
from doing
yeah.
that.
As long as you've got the space.
So one of the there's a In Chicago, there's a lot of availability for people who are paid GMs. I know a lot of them. There's a company here, and I don't know if it exists other places. It's called Wizard Staffing Co.
Yep. I've heard of them.
Yeah, so like they, it's the network of people who are, they mostly do D&D, but they're all around, and people go through them to hook up paid GMs with players. I know that Magpie Games also has a curated play. I don't know how you get involved. I mean, we had a person from Magpie talk about their curated games on an episode a few years back, I think. Go back and listen to that episode to get the details on that. I don't remember off the top of my head how you get involved with that. But I can
definitely, definitely for people interested in the Magpie thing, if you're looking to GM for Magpie, check the episode, but definitely go to the website, because I know their website really kind of, they've got a great website, and if there's a way for you to apply to be a GM and to kind of go through, because I know they kind of vet people to make sure that they're getting GMs that really kind of know their games. If there's a process in that, I'm sure 100% it's on the website, because their website is very inclusive of like everything you would ever want to know about Magpie games.
Yeah.
But check it out. Definitely. If that's your jam.
But I heard what really rings true for me, Sean, what you said about local game stores kind of becoming like event spaces. I've seen this at several different stores. Like, yes, we are running a lot of events because that's how we get foot traffic to our store. Yeah. It's how we sell more. And I've heard, for it depends, I guess, on the store and what they're selling and the kinds of clientele that they're getting. Sometimes that can increase foot traffic and get a lot of people in. But I think what would go, at least from my experience talking with people who run stores that do this, making sure that you're promoting the store itself once you're inside. Like, hey, you like this game? You can go buy it. Like, you can go.
Right, yeah.
Like, you should go buy something. They're giving us this space here. Or also, you know, they're taking money per head from the...
They do get money per head, but also, like, the, you know, weirdly enough, like, I feel like if you go to a game store, I'm not a friendly local game store owner. I am friends with several, but I don't have one myself. But I know that it's definitely been, like, the thing that keeps the roof up and lights on since like 1991 has been Magic the Gathering and the other card games. And so that's another big thing, is that like when you are planning your game night, you want to make sure you're not going up against any of their, you know, Pokemon or Magic or whatever tournaments, because they're, you know, they're not even going to be. So like if they do like a Thursday night Pokemon tournament and you're like, hey, I want to come in on Thursday, so they're gonna be like, we can't do that.
Right.
But when you're doing like, you know, D&D, obviously the one that I keep trying, and it's very weird because in both stores that I work at, I'm like, hey, I'm going to bring no dice, and then you guys will sell dice to the people here. And they're like, that's not really necessary. And it's very weird to me that like I always feel like, hey, here's a way that you guys can sell dice. Nobody wants that. Maybe your friendly local game store is different. Don't assume that the game store doesn't want to sell dice just because mine don't. I don't get it, but whatever. Most of them make their money on like chips and snacks. So, I mean, you know, obviously by supplying the game, you're sort of, I don't know, there's something about a bag of Lay's that is that much better when there's a D&D game around it, but.
It's true though.
It's I think with the proliferation of online purchasing, that game stores almost, it seems like they kind of by necessity had to find other ways to get people into the store, because they're going to sell, they will sell some stuff in the store, but like a game store that just makes its business and runs its business and keeps the business afloat just by selling RPG books and board games and card games, there probably aren't a lot of those still nowadays. Yeah. And they're going to be in markets where, like, because they thrive because there's no other game stores that do the other things, you know, that like that they're the only place. And so like selling the snacks, like, you know, that's not terribly different from how movies, you know, like,
no, it's very similar like, to movie, you know, theaters.
Movie theaters nowadays don't make their money off of the ticket sales. That all goes to the,
well, apparently they're making money off of paid GMing now too. So
they make their money off of, they make their money off of like the super combo, gigantic soda and popcorn combo, you know?
Yeah. $30 for a combo of a bucket of popcorn and a soda.
Yeah.
That cost them 25 cents to produce.
Right.
But that's part of the movie going experience. And so like the gaming experience is, you know, for many people also kind of having a soda and having some snacks and, yeah,
but the stores don't mark it up that bad. I've found, you know, just, they're not selling you soda for $30. yeah. And again, something to keep in mind is to make sure that there's enough of a demand, like, you know, like you were saying about something in the city, you know, like then, you know, if you're near Chicago or LA or New York, you can have a much easier time than I guess if you're near, you know, the middle of the desert. I haven't had really good luck with online games, and I know that I know that plenty of people do. I just don't know what I've done wrong, but like I haven't been able, like there's that Start Playing, which is the website that does online paid games, and I registered on that. I got nothing. But I don't know. It's just a nut I haven't been able to crack. I'm not saying it's a bad system. I'm just saying I haven't gotten it to work.
It's a nut that I've been having a hard time cracking myself. I've been trying to get games going, and it's just really hard
Right?
because I don't have any kind of online. I think it's because I don't have any kind of online presence.
I think that's it too. Yeah, I think that's part of, yeah, you gotta kind of have a online following or something.
Yeah,
You know, maybe do some
it's.
TikToks.
I
I don't
feel
know.
like th I feel like that is not surprising. That is, there are certain outlets for getting, like, you know, from Jess and I think about, you know, where we sell our games online, and there are certain outlets that have like this built-in audience that shows up to look and buy stuff, and then there's other websites where if you want to get sales there, you either have to engage regularly on the website, in the community around that site, or funnel them there from your own social media and that sort of thing until you at least kind of build some steam. And that might be the problem with Start Playing.
Yeah,
And so for those of you out there who are
I hear
looking to
you.
GM stuff, and you've just, you know, you've got like you're super active on social media and you've got all sorts of followers and you talk gaming with them all the time, then maybe Start Playing is would work better for you because you'd be able to funnel people over there a little more easily. And so you almost it's one of those, and being good at social media is like its own skill set that is
Oh my gosh,
constantly
yeah.
changing.
Oof. Yeah.
There was a time when I was good at social media. Not anymore, because I, you know, if I want to be producing games, it's I have to figure out where I'm going to put my time, and you know, keeping up with the latest of all the little nuances of how to really make social media work for me. I try to do some of it, but I'm certainly not an expert by any means.
Well, you go on, if you go on Discord, like you, there a lot of your favorite publishers are going to have their own Discord channels, and that's a great place to be like, hey, I'm going to run this. It's going to cost this much per person. And I know you guys are already fans of this game line. You want to come play. Like joining those Discords and seeing what they've got going on, what they have to offer. That is an easy way to get into social media. That's not like the sort of following influencer style that you would get on somewhere like Instagram, Blue Sky.
The soul sucking miasma that is just your broad post it into the ether and hope somebody reads it
Yeah.
type of social media. And that's one of those that the like community, it's, you know, it's more of a community that has a very particular kind of culture and stuff too. So like, you know, if you love a particular game and you'd like to run it and get people to pay you for it to run great games,
Yeah.
go into that company's Discord, spend a little time. Engage in some conversation, let people get to know you a little bit. Make sure that is like, oh, they like this person clearly knows the game. And then give it a shot.
Absolutely.
Right.
I
Should work.
mean, they also, I mean, a lot of these companies are going to be going to conventions too, and that's a form of paid GMing as well. Like if it's like you're getting your badge comped, is like on the low end of something. To getting paid per hour at a convention, there's a lot of places that offer that.
A Gen Con.
Yeah, Gen
Yeah, I mean
Con.
Gen, and I always forget that Gen Con is like technically paid GMing. Like they pay you for your for the games that you run. And I mean you could put in there that like the game is $200. I mean or whatever. And I mean there's nothing stopping you. I guess just other than logic. But yeah, I always want to try like, you know, like oh, let's see, I'm gonna do a game at, you know, I'm gonna be up at 10 a.m. So the price is 16 grand. And see if that works. All I need is one player. But then I'm really obligated to that one person, right? Like that's
You better bring a hell of a game.
yeah, it's gonna, oh, I didn't
It
expect to
better be
see you here.
something that
Oh boy.
changes like everything about their life
Yeah,
at that dollar.
it's gonna be. Hell of a game. I'll be like, ah, hey, it's me. You're seeing me before 10 a.m.
You come out of that game with like
you
a
don't
different
understand how
religion
important
and
this
completely
is.
at peace with the universe.
Yeah.
I mean,
I guess. Oh, go ahead, Jess.
No, you say what you're going to say.
I will say, I guess that form of professional GMing is the one that I am the most familiar with because whenever I'm doing conventions at, anime conventions or whether I'm going to Gen Con, like my badge is paid. I remember I did some GMing for Magpie 1 year, and they were very generous with the swag that they
Nice.
gave out. I got like a t-shirt, I got a digital copy, I got a physical copy.
That's how you do that.
Yeah, that it was
But then,
that
like,
was really
you can
nice.
take that, those people and sort of roll them into being like,
Yeah.
my first ever paid GM game was from a group that was at Gen Con. And, like, after the game, they're like, what happens next? And I'm like, geez, I don't know. Call me. And that was sort of a campaign grew out of that. So. That's not a bad plan. I mean, if you get like a group that really like gels at a convention table, you can always say, hey, look, I'm available. And this is a great,
Yeah.
any con is a great advertising opportunity for your skills.
It is.
It's also a great place where you can build up like your skills as a GM too, because I mean
That's true.
that's the whole thing. If I'm going to be paying money to go play a game, I want to have a good experience. I want to make sure it's running smoothly. I don't want to have to worry about anything. I want to have a good time. Otherwise, I'll roll the dice, no pun intended, finding myself a random table somewhere online for free. So doing those convention games, I think that that's like, how do you build your skills running for strangers? How do you make this set amount of time work and flow and pace well? Just like anything, like, you have to be good and constantly upping your game to make sure that you're staying afloat. Because there's a lot of people who their dream job is GMing for money, and you are competing with all those people whose dream job is GMing for money. And just like any other kind of creative industry or entertainment industry, I mean, are you in direct competition with all of them? No, but you're in direct competition with the idea that they can find entertainment elsewhere for better. Which is kind of like the same thing as writing games too. Like, I'm not in direct competition with other
Right.
people who are writing games, but I gotta make sure my game is as entertaining. Otherwise, why are they gonna play?
I will say when you're running a paid game, you kind of have to pivot a little bit away from like, so everybody here, I think, has run a game as like a play test, right? And it's a different skill set to do a play test or to do your own game where, if you're running your own game and it's just a thing that you do with your friends for free, that's something you're doing as much for yourself as, for them. I mean, as a DM, we do tend to like take on the whole like, well, woe is me, I'm the forever DM. But you wouldn't be doing it if you weren't enjoying it.
True.
But a paid game, you do need to keep in mind that the dynamic is somewhat different, and it gets real hinky when you're like, oh, your character died, right? Like, and somebody's like paying $20 for me to tell them, oh yeah, you died because of something you did. You need to be very careful about walking that line of like, what is it is sort of a combo of like storytelling performance and also, making sure that they understand that you are at the behest of the dice at the, at the end of the day, and making sure that ultimately everybody's happy with what they're getting. You want to like sort of feel out the audience and kind of do a game based on if you had an idea for a super serious horror scary game and a bunch of people show up making like goofball characters like Poopy McPoop Hat, within a certain amount you could be like, okay, well, could we call you like Schmoopy McPoop Hat, like you can kind of meet them halfway. But at the end of the day, you're like, okay, I guess I'm not doing that scary. I'm doing a more goofy thing. You are, performing. You're not, necessarily testing your own stuff. And that's an important thing. And I think that's the biggest tightrope to walk.
I would Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that it's really important right out of the gate that you kind of establish what the expectations are of your players as a professional GM and make sure that you're kind of on the same wavelength as them, just so you can make sure that, you know, they're going to have a good time and that you're not going to walk in there trying to craft this elaborate, like you said, this elaborate, complex political intrigue.
Right.
And they just want to kick down doors, kill monsters, and get loot.
Right, yeah.
I in my online game, I use Stars and Wishes as a way of kind of after every session checking in with my players and being like, okay, what did you like? What did you not like? What would you like to see more of? Because for me at least, GMing is a collaborative experience. It's not my story, it's our story. And I want to make sure
Exactly.
that the story that we're telling together is complementary and not antagonistic.
Right. I mean, you also want to make sure that one player in your group, especially if they're not all within the same group, or like maybe it's all a bunch of different people who don't really know each other. You don't want one person to ruin the fun for everybody else either.
Yes.
Like if I were running a theater
That's
production and I
very
had
difficult.
Yeah, and if I was running a theater production, I had one person in the audience who's treating it like a punk rock concert, moshing and yelling and screaming, I'm gonna kick them out. That person's gonna go because I have that prerogative as a paid as the entertainer. Like this is my show. Like yeah, it's our story, but this is my show. I get to decide who gets to stay and who gets to leave. Or who has to leave, I should say. And I know that there are some paid GMs out there who are really wary and loath to kick people out of their games because number one, they're paying, but number two, they're worried that if I kick them out, I'm gonna lose that stream of revenue. But just like any other, like any other time where you're kind of freelance, not freelancing, but like being an independent, either entertainer, trainer, something like that, where you're working with groups, you can fire your clients. You don't have to keep them around, especially if they're going to make, with a group effort, if they're going to make the rest of the group suffer, because then you'll lose all of them. And
Right.
then you'll have one shitty player and you've lost your chill players. I wonder if you, either of you, have you ever had a time when you've had to fire a client?
I have had definitely some hinky situations, but they typically tend to be like people sort of running into the administration of the store more than a problem with me personally. And what I try to do is keep everybody at like arm's length. You know, it's like, I mean, these guys are definitely my friends and they're cool, but also they're my clients. So, you know, if somebody vanishes, I'll ask somebody at the store, somebody else at the table, but that's it. I'm not gonna like hunt them down for like, you know, come back to game or anything like that. You know, 'cause that's, I feel a bridge too far. And you know, if there is an issue at the table, you know, that you need to resolve, you know, you're stepping into a very dangerous place. I recommend if you've got a problem at the table, just bring it directly to the people that run the store. If you don't have a store to bring it to, you're kind of stuck, and you know, then you are dealing with, you know, that situation, and you kind of just have to work it out with the rest of the players. But I've seen, especially in LARP, where you have to pivot from game master to group counselor, and that is not your skill set, and it will backfire very badly as often as not. So you really don't want to take on that role unless you are 100% certain what you're doing. Because it's, you know, it's something where a lot of people can get very upset.
I've had situations, not as a paid GM, but just in other games where there are times where you just need to have an open, honest conversation with someone and just let them know. Because sometimes
Yeah, that's true.
people will do things without realizing they're doing things. And when you stop and you tell them, they go, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't even realize that I was doing this or being this way. And usually they're like, you know what? Thank you for bringing this to my attention. We'll fix this. We'll work on this together. If you ever do run into that situation where you can tell someone is making a bad experience for everybody else, normally, I mean, if it's bad enough, if it's too bad, you may need to just be like, okay, everyone, we need to take five and then privately go talk to that person and be like, hey man, here's what's going on. Or hey person, here's what's going on. Your actions are causing strife, and we need to talk about, like, because I mean, maybe that person came in with an expectation that isn't what the rest of the group is doing. Maybe they were expecting, we're gonna kick open the door, kill the dragon and get its gold, and everybody else is like deeply committed role players who like want to tell this branching storyline of that focuses on their characters and their backstories and everything, and this person's just not gelling. And sometimes maybe the right answer is that person just leaves the group because it's just not the group for them. There is a group out there for them. Could be this just isn't the one. Or even I've had situations where I've been in a game and like I came in with a certain expectation and like that wasn't, the game that we're playing is the game that I was expecting, and it's not the game that I really want to play. So I quietly bowed out of it because I'm like, this just isn't my jam. This isn't what I wanted. And that's okay. Like, I don't begrudge any of the people there. I don't begrudge the GM. It's just not the experience I was looking for. And like Jess said, there may be times where you just have to fire a client because that's not only the best thing for you, but it's the best thing for the client. They can go find a group that plays the kind of game that they want to play, and they'll be happier for it than you just and the rest of the group just suffering, and they're not having a good time. That person's not having a good time, and everyone's just miserable.
I mean, and if it is one of the situations where, like, yeah, you want to play this kind of game, this is not the game that you want to play, maybe that's your opportunity to be like, hey, if we get a couple more players, I'll start playing this kind of game. And now you got two games going on, you
That's
got
true.
more money.
Yeah. Another thing you want to do is establish some basic ground rules. Like I did actually have some a situation where I had some players come in to a very early game of mine, and they were always very drunk, and not everybody else at the table. I've learned after doing this for a very long time and doing convention games where everybody shows up and everybody but me is very drunk. It's not impossible to run a great game with a table full of drunk players. They're gonna have the time of their lives, I promise. But either everybody needs to be drunk or nobody can be drunk. It can't be a mixed bag. So yeah, I had to deal with that and had like a group of players that were coming in stoned and drunk, and they were like, well, this is how you do this because this is how we've always done this. And I'm like, look, no judgment, man. If that's how you run your games, that's cool. But like these folks are, there's a lot of people here that are paying money to kind of get more of a story than what you're trying to do here.
Yeah, that would be my nightmare.
And again, once, if you get like a group of people that are like, we are all going to get loaded and play D&D, that is a thing. And I respect it. It requires a commitment that neither my schedule nor my liver could keep up with, but people do it and it's fine. I couldn't run for it. It's one of, but maybe you find somebody who can. And again, no judgment. It's, yeah, D&D and weed goes back like D&D and heavy metal. It's part of the whole thing, right? You can't take one without the other.
I just wanted to touch on Jess's something that you had mentioned that I hadn't had a chance to comment on was conventions are a really great way to train for this. You're going to get a lot of different types of people showing up. You're going to get a lot of experience running new games and running, getting a wide gamut of different types of people. And I will say that a lot of my best GM training, I guess I'll say, came from conventions, running, in some cases running games that I'd never run before, but learning the system. And when you're running at conventions, people really appreciate you telling a good story, and they really respond well to passion and you having fun as well. Because they're there to have fun and they're there to have a good time. But if you're not having a good time, they'll pick up on it very quickly and they will not enjoy it.
It's true.
One of the best compliments I ever got as a GM at a convention was I was running at Gen Con, I was running Capers. And after I got done, the people told me, they're like, "This was one of the best games we've had run for us at Gen Con. We could
Nice.
tell that you were knowledgeable, that you really loved what you were doing. You were very flexible with like the things that we wanted to do," which is partially because Capers is a very flexible system. But they're like, "We could tell you were having just as much fun as we were." And they then proceeded to go and they bought the book and they stopped at the table and they said, I'm going to assume they did, that they were going to talk to the person at the table and tell them that I had done such a good job. And then they were like, "Yeah, we went and played this other game with another GM and like he was mean and like he didn't seem like he was having a very good time." And yeah, that seemed kind of inconceivable to me because I'm like, "But you're there to run a game. Like, why wouldn't you have fun? Like, this is supposed to be fun. It's
Yeah.
Yeah, what are
I
you
don't know.
doing?
Yeah, what? Yeah, exactly. What are you doing? Why are you here if you're not having fun?"
Is very interesting to me how many people will put up with a game that they don't have fun with. And they'll spend a couple hours of their week every week like, oh my goodness. They're it can be better. It can be better.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so many more lucrative ways to have a bad time.
Yeah, there is.
If you're going to have a bad time, at least get something out of it, like something
Right?
more significant
Yeah.
than just pissing people off and walking away and thinking, well, that I'd enjoy that.
Well, let's take a few minutes and talk about our game design topic of the day, which is designing your own product line. Which I don't, or your own game line, I should say, because product line implies a few other things, although I know some people who have done this. I have
But if
no
only.
experience here, but Craig and Sean, you do. So let's hear it.
Right. You want to go first?
Craig, what do you mean by designing what does it mean to design your own game line?
Well, I think it means basically putting out more than just your core game book, putting out adventures, supplements, related games. It could be accessories and those types of things as well. And creating a whole line where a person comes in and buys your game, but then they see, oh, well, you've got a supplement that does this thing, and we've got a cool, like, here's a map that I can buy that I can put up on the wall and show everybody and point out where we are, in the continent or in the solar system or whatever. Just there's I that's been a topic that I've had on our list for a while, because I've done it, and now I'm at the point where I've done it in two different ways. One where it was kind of unplanned, where when I did Capers and I kickstarted that, and before the Kickstarter was over, I had people asking if there was going to be supplements or expansions or anything for the game, and I was like, I didn't plan to do that because I was just happy to get a game made. But I ended up polling the backers right before the campaign wrapped up, and got a lot of people who said they were interested. And I had to kind of take that with a grain of salt because we got a bunch of people who are kind of on an endorphin high. They just bought, like, they backed this game that they think is really cool and everything. And will that excitement still be there in a year when I do a supplement? And or hell, will it still be there next week? Or when the game comes out? But I decided to take a shot at it, and did multiple supplements, and then eventually, kind of the Capers game line kind of wrapped up with Capers Cyberpunk, which is kind of a full game book unto itself that kind of bookended this time period where all this superpowered gangster, superpowered criminals thing happened. With Cosmic Corsairs, that is on Kickstarter right now. Haha. The that was I went into it because Capers was wrapping up. I was like, I'm gonna give, I'm gonna plan for this. Like, do I have an idea for something that I can generate into a game line? And I took a very specific, I spent a long time kind of planning a bunch of stuff as far as what these other products and games might be, what kind of accessories there might be, what their, I had to give a lot of thought to the game system, and when I play tested the system, making sure that I was doing, generating a system that I was going to be able to reuse in other games and everything, and not suddenly I'll tweak the game system every time the new game, a new associated game comes out, because then that just creates confusion for players. So I had to kind of, cover things in the system that weren't necessarily going to be part of that game or weren't going to be focused on in that first game, because I know I'm going to do something with them down the road. And to that end, I spent many months. I want to say it was probably close to a year, just kind of tinkering in the background with the ideas for all of this before I started kind of implementing and making. And tinkering also meant kind of designing the basics of the system, just kind of making sure that I was happy with, at its core, it seems like this system will do everything I need it to do for all these ideas I have. And then also, because there's so much more going on with all of this, and I am a sole proprietor of all this thing, like Nerdburger Games is just me with a whole bunch of freelancers. I brought Chris on board to, he's credited in the book as story developer, which isn't a perfect credit name, but it's kind of close, kind of good for what it does. Basically, Chris, I didn't want to put you like idea guy and sounding board, which is like what you did a lot of.
Rubber duck.
I mean, that's why I introduced myself as creative consultant.
Yes.
I help you come up with creative ideas and flesh them out and turn them into something that you can then put in your game.
So right. And so I had to kind of explain everything that I was planning to do. We had a whole meeting and we've gone back and forth, and he's basically been on like an hourly retainer, essentially. We have a contract that he's just plinked away at. Like, there might be a period where he does a bunch of work and we go back and forth on a bunch of stuff, and then he might not touch it for 2 months. And then I bring up a question in Discord and we have a long protracted conversation over the course of a day and a half. And that's all just, like him taking all the ideas that I was having, thinking about where the problems might lie, expanding out, adding things to it that I may not have thought of, because that's one of the things that I know is my downfall. Sort of, it's a weak point, is that I am one imagination. More than one imagination is better. But I also am a person who likes to have control. So like not having a partner,
Also same.
a permanent partner, is like I like just having Nerdburger Games just be me, but I also like, having people to bounce things off of. And I do that a lot on my Discord anyway, but I knew I was going to be doing this a lot with at least somebody, at least one person. So I was like, well, okay, Chris, you've been a big Nerdburger Games supporter, been big on involved in all sorts of other things. I think you understand kind of what I try to go for with my games. And there's a lot of stuff that's in the game that I wrote, but is ultimately Chris's idea, or that Chris refined through discussion, or suggested something that I didn't think of, or in a few cases, browbeat me into saying, no, 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 I think you're missing a whole thing here. There's something that you should do this. And we really stuck to it. And there were times that I pushed back. And then he pushed right back, because as a designer, you kind of like my word is God. This is my I'm building the world. This is mine. And Chris knew that there were times when he needed to be like, hey, Craig, you're missing what I'm trying to say. This is what I'm trying, like, and he had to explain it, or kind of just push me harder. And so there's the complexity of all the different pieces and moving parts, and then finding a way to make all those pieces and moving parts come together. And I have found that, at least I feel this way right now, with Cosmic Corsairs and everything that's coming after it, that having somebody who is another person who is dedicated to doing that, and being on that journey with me in at least some respect in some portions of it. And then it also turned into a bunch of writing design work of his own. He wrote some adventures, he wrote some other stuff. So it's like the collaboration respect of all of it is a big is kind of a big deal. And that's because I'm dealing with games that are, relatively robust games. They're not like 400 page tomes, but they're going to be like 150 pages. If you were doing a game line that was going to be like a series of smaller games, like zine level stuff, or like maybe a little bigger than zines, you might not need as much of what I'm talking about here. So you can just kind of scale all that stuff back. Maybe it's just bouncing a few ideas off of somebody. You don't necessarily need a dedicated person. You don't necessarily need to partner, more, more equitably, where you've got a, more of a 50-50 split. Although I've done that with games too. I've co-designed games and co-written adventures. But yeah, it's there's a level of complexity and attention to detail and nuance that has to really kind of you have to put a lot a fair amount of time and effort into figuring that stuff out. If I was at a big if I was part of a big company, we were planning a game or a game line, and there were seven of us working on it, it'd be a different beast because you'd have all these different minds kind of coming and throwing ideas around, and even people who weren't directly involved might be like, "Oh, brainstorm, cool idea, shoot an email to somebody." Whereas if you're doing it by yourself or in a partnership, it's much more limited in that respect. So that's kind of the baseline of everything that's going on. We can talk a little bit more about like how I, what the choices that I made as far as like what sort of, what types of supplements and other materials to create for the game. But if you know Capers, you know what that has been. And we can let Sean talk a little bit here too, because he's got a whole universe of games that are all kind of, you've done with the Remembrex universe sort of what I'm looking to do with the what I, what is referred to as the Aether Space game line that starts with Cosmic Corsairs. You've got a whole series of games that stand on their own, but that are all kind of part of this world. So.
And that did grow out of the initial success of Remembrex. I was actually looking it up yesterday, and it was like 2017 that we did that, and it simultaneously feels like much further ago and not that long ago. It's very weird to think like, oh yeah, I was 2017. That was over 5 years. Feels like it's been forever. And then obviously 2020 was 17 years in and of itself. So we did Remembrex, and so the backstory of this is that initially the idea for Nerdy City was it was going to be a LARP company. We were going to be doing LARPs, we had a game called Ex Arcana that we wanted to do, and we were part of a larger company called Eschaton. And we just wanted to run our little Ex Arcana LARP and have fun with that. It was going fine. We did a Kickstarter for Ex Arcana through Eschaton. It did okay. We created this whole thing called Chronos, which actually I have some questions for you guys afterwards about that if you have some time. But the Chronos thing, grew into us doing Ex Arcana and doing a couple of other LARPs, and then I sort of threw together this idea of, hey, I'm gonna do this game about like kids in the 80s, dealing with like government conspiracies and analog horror, and it just happened to be 2016, right place, right time. This show called Stranger Things came out, and boom, huge hit. I mean, at least for us, it was a big hit. So we sort of took the entire playbook that we had and sort of did a giant pivot into, okay, we're just going to be publishing tabletop from here on in for a lot of reasons. Primarily the, success of this game, but other stuff going on and with LARP, and it just made more sense to be doing what we were doing, and we were enjoying it more, which is the primary reason. I took about a year. We did a game called RPG Nasty, which is the ongoing gig is that it's a terrible game, and we should never ever tell anyone to play it. It is disgusting and juvenile and stupid and moronic, and it is all of those things, and that's why you're going to have a good time. But you're not going to feel good about yourself. Like, you're not going to feel like, you know, some sort of genius afterwards. You're going to be like, oh, that was stupid. And that's what makes it fun. It's always been our top seller. It's a, you know, little zine game. And the idea of RPG Nasty is that it is the 70s slasher that your characters watch, you know, in that Tarantino film within a film. This is the movie that your characters watch during the campaign of Remembrex that you're playing. You know, like Saturday night, we got like the grossest horror movie at the video store, and we all sit around and watch it. And then you play that, and it's the, and so we were like, okay, there's, you know, there's legs to this. There's ways that we can do this that sort of, and the idea of like expanding out the concept of broadcast and pop culture and television, you know, the thing that makes the 80s the juggernaut that it is the pop culture of the era. And after taking some time to really consider it, we were like, okay, what do we love about it? And it was what Megan calls the plastic mythology, the Saturday morning cartoons, the action figures, the breakfast cereals. So I started leaning into development on Commandroids, which is set in the Remembrex universe, but you know, there's a group of giant alien robots that have taken over our machines and transform into, you know, jet fighters and sports cars and vacuums and things. And that went really well. I mean, you know, there was some touch and go parts with the Kickstarter, but it wound up working out. And the Transformers fans really came in, and we learned an interesting thing about like developing as a line is that all of these things have their own independent fan base, but by filing off the what's the word I'm looking for?
Serial numbers.
The serial numbers. Thank you. Yeah. Instead of making a game about Dracula, you make a game about vampires, you know, and somebody made a lot of money that way. We were just trying to follow that exact, you know, system. And like, it's very much like that. Right. So then we did Holomatics, which is fashion doll, new wave rock stars versus the aliens. And you know, it was very obviously it's an homage to Barbie and the Rockers and Kid Video and Jim and the Holograms especially, but it can kind of cover all those bases. The other thing we realized is there is a whole fan base for that, and there's conventions for that. So there's a Transformers convention, there's a Gem convention, and I guess here is as good a place as any for me to make an announcement. coming next, Myrmidons of Midkyria. You know, He-Man, She-Ra, Thundercats, Sword and Planet, 80s space barbarian, space princess stuff. Mm. And, you know, the work is already underway to get that ball rolling and out the door. And so, you know, we're finishing off Holomatics, that's the next one that we're going to be doing. That also has its own fan base. So, you know, that's one where we could, you know, go and start running that at like, you know, there's sort of He-Man and Thundercats conventions that do that. But having something outside of, you know, the standard like Gen Con Origins rotation gives us an opportunity to hit players that ordinarily we wouldn't hit. And that's really been, you know, the place that's made this whole thing work. But for me, and like what I'm loving about this is the opportunity to take these universes and these sort of established concepts and mash them all together, you know, and we're doing all these like zine games that also will expand out this universe. That, you know, like, you know, what if Master Splinter was the guy who trained Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes, that kind of thing that like, you know, if all of these mythologies are in one place, it lets you do things that, you know, the actual licenses won't let you do, you know. I know there's a Transformers game. I know there's a He-Man game, but they can never cross over because one's Hasbro and one's Mattel. But Myrmidons of Midkyria and Commandroids get along just fine. And that's been an exploring is that like, and how did these two universes like shape each other? So there was, you know, maybe in the history of it, there was like conflict between these two planets that left like a colony of robots on Midkyria that aren't transforming robots, but still have some of the DNA of the command droids and things like that, that's been a lot of fun is developing that. And the way to do that, and the way that we did all of this really, this is highly specific instructions, but I promise it will work. Marry somebody from very far away and then have to drive to their parents' house.
Yes, this is
So
I recommend this as well. This is a good
yeah,
strategy.
right. My wife and I, and obviously I don't mean marry, so you could have like a best friend and you just go on road trips, whatever. But the point is having these long drives. My wife's from Chicago, we live in Jersey City, so we drive to Chicago every so often. We also drive to Gen Con. Rememorex was entirely conceived on the way back from Gen Con. Fun fact, midway between Indianapolis and Jersey City is the town of Clearfield, Pennsylvania, which is what gave its name to Clearfield, Delaware in Rememorex. That's we just drove past and we were like, what's the name of the town? And we saw Clearfield. We were like, oh, okay, that's it. It's Clearfield. So that sort of a thing, like, and it's like you said, sounding boards are critical. You definitely need somebody to talk to who can occasionally be like, that's good, let's follow that, or this whole thing you're saying is complicated and stupid, and let's get rid of it. And there's the whole creative, we don't need to get into the weeds on, being ready to kill your babies, and even if you've got a precious idea, but if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You got to let it go. All of that, that's all part of the creative process.
All of our best ideas, me and Alex have been when we've been driving somewhere like to Vermont. So I agree wholesale with everything that you're saying there. What I'm hearing from both of you is that like, 'cause it's very different. The two lines that Craig and Sean are talking about are very different in terms of like how these game lines are. Like Sean, you have this game line where you can have these very different flavors of games in this one universe, and it has this fan base already built in. But like Craig, with something like Capers, it was here is an idea that can be expanded so much, and people really liked it. Like they liked that property, and they want more from that property. I think that if you find your niche in either of those two sections, like this is a game line that, yeah, I'm developing this idea on it. Where else can we take it that people who like this kind of thing will like in the future? That's the golden key for a game line, I think. So I think some good ideas to generate from those two types of game lines.
Chris, what has been your experience? And this is not a prompt for you to, say nice things about me, because I know that our back and forth has been a little bumpy a few times. There's a few times that
Oh,
Chris has
yeah.
suggested something, and I've been like, please, come on, Chris. And then, we continued the discussion and kind of came to a better understanding. But this is, I think, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the first time that you've been involved in, I know it's for me, it has been like the first time that you've been involved in, a game line or something, extensive like that to this level.
To this level, yes. I know that, like, I was an avid fan of Capers, still am an avid fan of Capers. It's my favorite game. And I know that I was one of those people who were like, you should do a Capers set in this setting or that setting, or
You were.
yeah, I think both methods kind of work. And you could also kind of look at like other games that do game lines, like Vampire the Masquerade pops out, where they did Vampire the Masquerade and they did Demon the Fallen and then they did Mage and they did Werewolf, where it was all sort of different aspects of this same world. Which, I mean, it kind of sounds like, Sean, that's what you're doing in your game line, is it's
Yeah,
they're all these
absolutely.
different
We
aspects of the same world.
use that as a template.
And that's kind of what, Craig, you're doing too with the Aether Space Saga. Is it's the first game is focusing on the Corsairs, and the cosmic powers, and the next game's going to focus on other things, which I won't talk about right now.
Oh, I've talked about it. The next one will be like the internal political game of trying to take the government down from the inside.
Yes.
And that's secret scions. Yeah, that's that the World of Darkness is very much an influence into trying to do this. The one thing that always bothered me about the World of Darkness is that these creatures that were featured in, you know, in different game books, they used the same system, but there were subsystems within. There were parts of the system, and there were things about how those creatures and their abilities and everything functioned that did not play well together.
Yes,
Like there were
absolutely.
there was definite power shift and problems where it was difficult to be like, I'm gonna have a werewolf show up in a changeling game. Okay, well now all of my changelings are dead.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I actually did run for it wasn't like a professional game or anything, but I did run a setting where it was supposed to be like it was like an intelligence agency that was trying to recruit the different supernatural aspects of the World of Darkness. So, yeah, I mean, there is a huge power disparity between, say, like werewolves and vampires. A single werewolf can wipe out an entire coterie of vampires, no problem. Unless the vampire players are very, very careful and very, very clever about how they deal with that. But you can kind of. It's hard. It's very difficult, but you can kind of find a balance in there.
It
But it was
requires a
never
lot of
designed.
thought and house ruling and saying, we're
Yes.
going to put these two creatures together, but we're not going to do this thing over here that's intrinsic to this creature and to how this
Well,
game functions.
I'm.
We're gonna scale that back because otherwise it's gonna potentially cause problems. You had to really think about all that sort of stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. Those games, like the games on their own, were great, but that always just kind of irked me that they didn't play well terribly well.
I've always run
Played
them
together
together.
terribly well.
I'm running them together on Mondays professionally. And I found that like there is a sort of rock, paper, scissors to it. The thing that everybody says, you know, is like and I felt like this was the intrinsic lesson of it, right? Is that like, you know, yes, a werewolf will physically mop the floor with a mage or vampire, but that was never supposed to be the only arena of conflict.
Yes.
And that was what I thought was so fascinating about it, is like, yeah, that's just one way they can win, but it's also very short term. And since we're so, you know, we're so conditioned to think of combat supremacy as being the only way to quote unquote win a role-playing game, because that was how you won D&D, that like that was somehow like a better superiority than what the vampires or the changelings were bringing to the table. And it isn't. It's very short term. Because, you know, if a vampire, you know, like if a werewolf meets a vampire and like kills that vampire, yeah, the player is done, right? And then obviously you got that. But there's also, you know, there's going to be immediate repercussions for that werewolf that are going to make it very miserable. And then like and that's part of that whole rock, paper, scissors. And that was something that I wanted to build into Commandroids. And this was something we had a lot of discussion about, was with Commandroids and Holomatics. It's like, you know, when you've got one player that is a jet fighter, right? And he's the 30-foot tall robot, and one player is like, I'm a rock star. It does seem like a huge discrepancy, but we wanted to build in a thing where the abilities that that rock star has mean that that jet fighter is, you know, on his best behavior. And you know, the big equalizer is the Rainbow Riders, right? Like we wanted to have, you know, because this is Saturday morning cartoons, we wanted to have like a place for, you know, the Shirt Tails and the Popples and My Little Pony and the Care Bears that typically are never part of this like high octane action and adventure world. But like, if they did come into it, what would it look like? And we decided it would be Lovecraftian and terrifying. So they would be, and we've made it very clear, like, you know, in the sections on like other stuff you will find in the universe, there's almost nothing scarier than a Rainbow Rider. Like, everybody backs down when the Rainbow Riders come into the room. Because of what they're bringing to the table. And it is part of that, you know, that power scaling thing where we wanted to do something where the Rainbow Riders are technically the most powerful, but they also bond to the youngest humans. So they're very easily manipulated. And so, yes, a Rainbow Rider can easily decimate a 30-foot jet fighter. But if that jet fighter happens to have like even a little bit of Starscream in him, he's going to know how to manipulate this guy against his enemies, you know, because it's ultimately a very small child in there that has access to all this power. And I feel like if that rock, paper, scissors, like, you know, thing hadn't been built into the first three, especially World of Darkness games, Mage, Vampire, and Werewolf, I wouldn't have the template to build on for this. So I do like that. That's, you know, that discrepancy that isn't a discrepancy is a core element of the world that Megan and I are trying to build.
That's tough to do. Like, it's like the problem of when you're making a game and the game is big and there's a lot more stuff to look at than when your game is small. Like, you're making a bigger game, just not all at once. And
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
that is a big lift.
Like in the Aetherspace games, there's, you know, this it, you're in this solar system that has an atmosphere in it. The aether that fills that atmosphere, that is that atmosphere that fills the space between planets, allows a number of things to happen that kind of propel how the games function. It allows the transmission of cosmic energies. It allows heat to propagate out to the farthest reaches, so all the planets are habitable. And, you know, it explains some science stuff. It explains some mystical stuff. But then also, I know, and Chris knows, why Aetherspace is like that, and that is a thing that's going to be revealed. And I had to figure that out so that I could put clues in the first game book, so that when the last game book comes out and we actually reveal this is where it came from, and these are the ramifications of that, then we can kind of have that pay off. So that was one of the things that came out, was like, here's four or five different game ideas. How can we interlace them all a little bit and kind of make sure that we have a logic for setting up this reveal of this secret that will ultimately have, you know, some significance. Whether or not players decide to latch onto it and really use it, that's up to them. But it will have significance.
It's a lot. That's a lot
It
to
is.
Yeah, and I kind of wish, and it was something that I feel like there were some questions in the Capers universe that never really got answered
Oh, yeah,
in terms of
absolutely.
like things that got touched upon in some of the expansions and even the core game. Of things that like I've had to kind of develop into my own mythos as I'm running my paid campaign, because each campaign is the first one was the base game, the second one was the first expansion, the third one was the expansion after that. So it's like 20-year periods where I'm going through and I'm having to explain like what's happening in the world and where these things come from and stuff like that. That like obviously for when you don't plan a game line, it's hard to work that stuff in. When you have a planned game line, then it's easier to sort of make the decision of, well, is this going to stay mysterious or are we going to explain that? But I would, if there ever is a Capers version 2, I would like to see some of those questions get answered.
It was one of those things when I was developing Capers, is I wasn't thinking in those terms. I was thinking about like, okay, you know, every 20 years there's like a new setting, a new kind of focus for the game, where it goes from being shoot 'em up gangsters to being kind of a noir thriller to being a James Bond style spy thing, you know, but it's always some
Cool.
version of cops and robbers with superpowers. and kind of making each one of those things function and be cool in and of themselves. But having there is some connective tissue there. Like there were things that were thought about there, but there were things that, you know, I'm sure didn't get as developed as well as they could have been if I had been taking a much more holistic approach and thinking about things more early on, and generating that interconnectivity, and having everything kind of progress from A to B to C to D more cleanly. So that was, you know, part of the reason that the whole Aether Space thing is getting more of that treatment, because I think it'll ultimately create a more holistic series of games where each game can be played standalone. Each game can also function as a supplement to every other game.
Yeah,
so
I like
you
that.
And so you can pick and choose how you want to integrate things. You want to play Cosmic Corsairs? Great. You're all space pirates, you know, blown up triarchy starships and moon bases, but somebody wants to play a psychic character. So we're going to go and they make one of those, and we're going to go, you know, delve inside the government at some point. We're going to have an undercover covert mission where they get to shine every now and then.
I mean, that kind of stuff is what, like, that's why stuff like D&D and Pathfinder is so successful, because they have a bunch of different supplements. They have this really robust game line. There's a lot of different support. People like it because they don't have to learn a whole new rule set to play the same kind of game. I know that's very appealing to people. But the thing that they have a disadvantage over is that they don't really do, D&D doesn't do other genres super, super well.
No. No.
Where if you are...
Doesn't stop planning, him from trying.
No, it does not. But if you're planning from second the edition. Beginning, right, if you're planning from the beginning about how you're going to conduct yourself, and like, I do want to have these kind of sort of other game feels, like I do want to have an investigative kind of feel for one of my games in this line, you can plan ahead for that with your rule set, instead of having to do, here's fantasy, but we're going to shove a mystery into the box that's labeled fantasy. We might have to make this a whole little limited series for ourselves, how to develop a game line, because there's a lot in here that I think we haven't even touched, and we've talked over our normal allotted hour of podcasting time, because I think that there's so much to dig in there. But yeah,
it's a rich vein.
It is.
Really is. Do we have any final thoughts before we sign off?
Rememorex, Commandroids, RPG Nasty, and soon to be Holomatics are on DriveThruRPG, kids.
Well, yeah. Sean, Chris, thanks so much for coming on. It's
Thank
always
you.
Fun when we have multiple guests.
And I apologize for being late. That's my bad.
Oh no, you're okay. Thank you for showing up. Sean, since you already got started, where can we find you and your stuff? Where can we find RPG Nasty and Holomatics and
it's all on drive through RPG, and also we have nerdycity.com. You know, feel free to reach out, ask questions, whatever. We're there. I think we have a Discord. We should. Yeah. God. Don't get old, kids. It's rough.
Chris.
You can find me at auraofawesomegames@gmail.com. You can find me on Discord at aura_of_awesome. You can find me at start.playing as aura_of_awesome. And if you want to hire me to help you develop your role-playing games, you can find me on Fiverr as Chris_Boyer_GM.
You can find me at wannabegames.com or on itch at wannabegames. You can also donate money to the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights if you want to make me happy. Don't buy my games right now.
And you can find me on Kickstarter right now. Cosmic Corsairs is live. That's the only place to do anything for me in any way, shape, or form. Go there.
Yeah.
listen to other episodes to find out the other places I am. Hopefully by the time you are listening to this, it's already rocking and rolling and doing
yes.
well. But as of right now, it's 2 days before the campaign starts, and I am a bundle of nerves.
Yeah. Oh, I know that feeling. You're going to be a bundle of nerves for about, let's say, 32 more days.
Anyway.
But yeah, thank you. Thank you to Avel. Thank you to Steph Sachs for opening closing theme song, which is Avel, which I always try to get right. Licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sachs. And thanks all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Bye, everyone.